Today, calls to limit speech rights continue, driven by concerns ranging from national security to racial unrest. For us, as with the founders of 1798, the question is whether we'll look beyond our current struggles to preserve this essential right for generations to come. In his new book, Liberty's First Crisis, Adams, Jefferson, and the Misfits Who Saved Free Speech, author Charles Slack examines the very first time that this freedom was tested in America during the 1798 Sedition Act. It's a great pleasure to welcome Charles Slack to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Very nice to have you here. Again, the title of the book, Liberty's First Crisis, Adams, Jefferson, and the Misfits Who Saved Free Speech. What brought you to this particular idea of looking at these two men and the other misfits and ultimately free speech?
Well, I think as a writer, I've always been deeply interested in First Amendment rights, the right to speak and write unfettered by the government. And so I've actually spoken to school groups sometimes as a writer, and I tell them one of the things I love most about this profession is there's only one license you'll ever need, the First Amendment. And so it had always fascinated me ever since I first heard of the Sedition Act of 1798 that there was a time just after the Bill of Rights was passed when the government actually made it for a time illegal to criticize the government. So it's a story that always fascinated me, and that's what set me on my journey of exploring it.
So talk a little bit about what the Sedition Act meant to the country, which still, 1798, obviously very much in its infancy.
Yes, well, I think what had happened was everybody during the Revolutionary period and the war against England, everybody knew that they wanted to be free, they themselves. And so the Bill of Rights, Congress shall make no law, abridging free press and freedom of speech, was made with the highest ideals, and I think people were primarily thinking about their own personal liberty and the common enemy being the British. And I think what happened was when the United States set on course as an independent country, and suddenly it was Americans in power and getting a taste of what it felt like to be on the receiving end of vicious articles and vicious verbal attacks, they didn't like it. And so in practical reality, the Sedition Act became this incredible hurdle we had to get over to decide, did we want to pay the price for being free?
And with that said, certainly politicians in 1798 had good reason to fear their critics. So how could they then pass this law that decreed fines and imprisonment for anyone who publicly criticized election officials?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. The fear, as I say in my first sentence of the book, is the greatest enemy of liberty.
Right.
Because when you're not afraid, it's pretty easy to put up with opinions that you may not agree with. But the United States was at a crisis point. We had a weak federal government that was just sort of getting started. You had lots of internal dissension about whether we needed a strong federal government or not. And then on top of that, you had the United States being constantly sort of threatened by the two looming superpowers of the day, England and France. And there were different camps in the United States about which of those countries represented the greater threat. And so it was a time when people were really unsure whether the country itself would survive. And so it seemed like these freedoms were a pretty high price to pay. And I think, of course, the lesson that came out of it was that, yes, we would put up with speech we find obnoxious, and that really cherishing free speech is sort of makes us stronger, not weaker.
So, interestingly, Charlie, the two of the people that you talk about in this book, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. So it's very much like a boxing match in this corner and then in this corner. So let's start with John Adams, president, leader of the Federalists, besieged on all sides by his critics. And what led him to then sign the Sedition Act?
Yes, that's a great question. I think that John Adams signing the Sedition Act into law was a personal tragedy for him because of all of the founders. He had been one of the most forceful and eloquent on the subject of free speech. And as a younger man, he had even written that printers and journalists should never let a person in power tell them that what they write is sedition. And then here he was a few decades later as a 63-year-old president, besieged on all sides, being the people in his own party trying to get him to go to war with France, people in the opposition party accusing him of being a warmonger, and being really viciously attacked in the press on a daily basis. And I think that he did what rulers throughout history had done, which is he decided to use his power to shut them up. He didn't like so much being on the receiving end of all this criticism.
So then let's look at Thomas Jefferson, who is the vice president of the United States and is very much the leader of the opposition party and working feverishly to undermine and dismantle this new law.
Yes, Jefferson was an interesting position. At that time, the president and vice president didn't run on the same ticket, as it were, because parties were sort of looked on as an evil, not something that the founders had envisioned. And so the way it worked was John Adams had won the election, and he was president. Thomas Jefferson had come in second, and so he was vice president. But Jefferson and Adams had very different philosophies, and Jefferson, as you say, was the leader of this emerging party known as the Democratic Republicans or Republicans. And he really did. He worked sort of on the sly to undermine the Sedition Act, and he paid some of the writers to criticize John Adams, and then ultimately he, along with James Madison, wrote the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions, which came out very strongly. They did it anonymously, but they came out very strongly asserting the rights of states to rebel against the federal government if it passed laws of this nature.
In today's political culture, we don't think of vice presidents having that much power.
Well, he didn't have a whole lot of power per se within the Adams administration. In fact, interestingly, when Congress passed the Sedition Act, it made it illegal to criticize the president and members of Congress, but it didn't say anything about the vice president because Thomas Jefferson was an opponent and was the vice president. So it wasn't so much that he wielded so much power, but he was a very respected major figure, political figure and thinker of the time, and so he drew on all those resources to do whatever he could to undermine Adams in this way.
So to use that word undermine, what did he do to undermine it?
Well, he supported writers such as James Callender and Benjamin Franklin Bache, who were journalists who were highly critical of Adams, and he supported them. And as I say, he wrote the Kentucky Resolution, which really threatened essentially that the state might secede if the federal government pursued policies such as this.
Charles Slack is our guest. The name of the book, Liberty's First Crisis, Adams, Jefferson, and the Misfits, Who Saved Free Speech. You talk about Benjamin Franklin Bache. He is the grandson of Benjamin Franklin. And talk a little bit about his ideals and how he came to ultimately be a power player in this and be one of those misfits.
Yes, Benjamin Franklin Bache was one of my favorite characters in the book. As you say, he was Benjamin Franklin's grandson. As a young boy, he had traveled with Franklin to France on Franklin's diplomatic mission. And while there, while in Europe, he developed an abiding love for France. And he also was an absolutely devoted admirer of his grandfather and of his grandfather's ideals for liberty. So when he returned to the United States, and after Benjamin Franklin died and left Benjamin Franklin Bache, left Bache his printing equipment, Bache started a newspaper in Philadelphia called the Aurora. He was such an idealist that what he really hated was to see the actual workings of government. And so when George Washington and then John Adams became presidents, Bache turned against both of them very sharply, in some cases viciously, when he saw them making what he saw were compromises, and particularly what he saw as policies favoring the English and disfavoring the French. And ultimately, he did things that was sort of a precursor to WikiLeaks, if you will. He would intercept government documents and print them in the Aurora. And ultimately, he was charged, and he was awaiting trial, manning his printing press in Philadelphia when he died of the yellow fever during the epidemic of 1798, and he was only 29 years old. But he left, I think, a lasting legacy in the fight for free expression and free speech.
Through the Aurora, just to spell this out a little bit, through the Aurora, he leaked a document from the French minister that was meant for the president during what was called the XYZ affair. Talk a little bit about that affair.
Well, the XYZ affair was a case where the French foreign minister had essentially, the French had been sort of attacking, assaulting, harassing U.S. ships on the high seas. And this was a case where the U.S. sent diplomats over to try to negotiate a solution to this problem, and the French essentially demanded bribes. And the three French agents who were nameless, who demanded the bribes, were labeled X, Y, and Z. And so that's where the term the XYZ affair came from. And of course, when news of that leaked, it really raised resentment and against the French in the United States, and many calls for war with France.
Since our listening area encompasses the state of Vermont, the story of Matthew Lyon is a fascinating one, because here is an Irish immigrant who comes to the Green Mountains of Western Vermont and ultimately becomes a U.S. congressman and a real powerhouse.
Exactly. Matthew Lyon is a wonderful character. He came over as an indentured servant from Ireland at the age of about 14, and he landed first in Connecticut, and then as a young man he migrated north to what was then a wild territory of Vermont. And he built sort of a business empire near Lake Champlain. And as he sort of accrued power within the state, when Vermont became a state, he was elected to Congress. He traveled down to Philadelphia, which was the capital. And he created quite a stir, because he was really sort of a street fighter. He never backed down, and he always had a reaction when people criticized him. And the Federalists, who were in power at the time, were especially suspicious of and fearful of immigrants. Some of these problems that we have in this country are eternal. So even back in 1798, people were worried about too much immigration. And one Federalist politician had famously thundered that we couldn't have, quote, hordes of wild Irishmen, close quote, coming into our country. Now, here was Matthew Lyon, an Irish immigrant, now not just in our country, but in Congress. And so he was a lightning rod, and ultimately, for statements that he made running for reelection, criticizing John Adams, he was arrested for sedition, thrown into jail in Vermont, and wound up getting reelected from his cold prison cell in Vermont. And it was really a turning point in the Sedition Act drama.
You talk about, just going back a little bit, January 1798, this battle of insults on the House floor, with Lyon spitting in the face of a representative from the state of Connecticut, Roger Griswold, And then later when Griswold retaliated, the pair ended up having this fight, a quite bloody fight, on the floor of the House of Representatives.
Absolutely. This was one of the incidents that convinced the Federalists that they needed to do something to get rid of Matthew Lyon. It always amuses me, having sort of researched this case, when people talk about we need to return to the civil days of politics, because just as you say, Roger Griswold made a cutting comment about Matthew Lyon, and Lyon turned and spit in his face. And then Congress spent about 2 weeks deliberating whether to throw Matthew Lyon out. They failed to muster the votes, and so Griswold took matters into his own hands and attacked Lyon with a cane. Lyon picked up some fire tongs and went at it, and it was bloody. They were both emerged from it okay, but ultimately this was one of the catalysts that, as I say, told the Federalists they needed to get rid of Matthew Lyon, and so he was a big part of why the Sedition Act was passed.
Certainly Benjamin Franklin Bache and Matthew Lyon were misfits, and yet when you compare them, you look at Benjamin Franklin Bache, who was the grandson of Benjamin Franklin, you look at Matthew Lyon, who became a congressman, and then you write about Luther Baldwin, who really embodies that idea of a misfit.
Yes, that Luther Baldwin was unusual among the those arrested under the Sedition Act, because he wasn't a politician, he wasn't a writer, he wasn't especially a thinker. He was a waterman. He made his living on the rivers around Newark, New Jersey, where he lived, in his small boat. Well, one morning he was out drinking with some of his friends, and President Adams and Abigail Adams were passing through Newark in their carriage on their way from Philadelphia to Massachusetts, and a ceremonial cannon fired off, and somebody joked that they were shooting at the president's rear end, and Luther said, well, I don't care if they shoot through his rear end. They didn't use the word rear end, but he said, I don't care if they shoot through it. And the tavern owner turned to him and said, that's sedition. And for Luther Baldwin, it was the beginning of a well over a year odyssey where he was pursued by an ambitious prosecutor looking to make a name for himself, and ultimately a very long ordeal over this sort of ill-advised, not terribly funny, and not and maybe a stupid comment, but certainly hard to imagine being arrested for that. But that's what happened to him. And the case of Luther Baldwin is sometimes dismissed as sort of a comic footnote because of the humorous elements and the fact that he wasn't a thinker. But to me, it was sort of a very important case because it shows just how quickly a law like the Sedition Act, which is meant to round up a few people, can really reach its icy fingers down into the population. And if we're not safe to make a dumb comment on a street corner, then we really aren't doing a good job of protecting freedom.
So when Americans refused to let all of this go, and they penned editorials and they signed petitions and they were very upset, talk to us a little bit about the actions that Thomas Jefferson and James Madison ultimately took to drop the resolutions of Kentucky and Virginia to overturn this.
Well, the resolutions were important sort of line in the sand that at that time the Supreme Court did not have its role. Nowhere in the Constitution does it say the Supreme Court will review laws to say whether they're constitutional or not, and that wouldn't come until a little bit later. So there really was no way to sort of check Congress to see whether the laws were constitutional or not. So I think the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions sort of put the states in that role potentially by saying that states might not stick around if Congress passed laws like this. But I think what really happened, I think Americans, this is a pattern we've seen throughout history, that Americans don't always recognize right away when there are threats to liberty, but over time, I think people woke up. I, think the spectacle of Matthew Lyon being arrested and then reelected to Congress from jail, the Luther Baldwin case, which was a big case in its time, a guy on a street corner getting arrested for a dumb comment, the Benjamin Franklin Beach, I think people started to wake up to what was at stake, and that maybe just letting people have their say, even if we violently disagree with them and can respond with aggressive words but not violence, that putting up with speech we don't like is really a necessary part of freedom.
And I guess most recently, of course, we saw this in the months and years following 9/11.
Yes, I mean, this is something, you know, I think, as I said at the outset, that fear is sort of a real catalyst for calls to limit freedom, and we certainly saw it. There was a Sedition Act passed during World War I, as if people had forgotten 1798, and people under the Sedition Act then and the Espionage Act were thrown in jail for opposing the draft and for giving speeches. We saw the McCarthy era, the House Un-American Activities Committee, and so I think that these lessons that were learned in 1798, they're important hurdles, but we really have to sort of be mindful that we don't, in our getting upset and fearful over some crisis that's current, don't wind up doing more harm than good by destroying liberty for the long term.
It's a fascinating chapter of our history. The name of the book is Liberty's First Crisis: Adams, Jefferson, and the Misfits Who Saved Free Speech. The book is published by Grove Atlantic. Charles Slack, thank you very much for spending time and sharing your expertise with us. I do appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book, Liberty's First Crisis: Adams, Jefferson, and the Misfits Who Saved Free Speech. The book is published by Grove Atlantic. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.